This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. The values of the Enlightenment played a key role in the rapid advancement of humankind on Earth, according to Steven Pinker, author of the new book, Enlightenment Now. Pinker argues that life is getting better across a wide variety of metrics, and we ought to understand why. Why write this book? If I read your other books, and I see that all the trend lines are in the right direction, and Enlightenment values have contributed mightily to that, why take a victory lap in pointing out how great it is?
Most people are unaware of the progress that I attribute to the Enlightenment. People think that globally poverty is getting worse, whereas in reality it's getting better. They think that war is getting more severe, whereas in fact over the decades it's been lessening. So in measure after measure of human progress, people actually get the sign wrong. they think things are getting worse, whereas the reality is that they're getting better. Also, the Enlightenment project that I credit with these improvements is by no means a consensus. There are powerful counter-enlightenment movements from the academic and intellectual left, from the political right. So it's by no means a victory lap.
So what is the most credible claim that you would attribute to the anti-enlightenment left?
The most credible claim?
Yeah. What do you think is the most salient or what are the claims from the academic left that you say, I should really think about that?
Well, I try to address them in the book. I mean, to reproduce their arguments, which I don't accept. They blame the Enlightenment for colonialism, for slavery, for the world wars, for the Holocaust, for the threat of nuclear weapons, for possibly catastrophic climate change, for pollution. So all of the everything bad that has happened in the last couple of centuries, the academic left blames on the Enlightenment.
Now, is it your sense that those people are just taking the world that they live in as the default position? And saying, well, all of these other things that we want to do with the world, those are improvements upon what we have now.
Yes, they imagine a future where after Western civilization has collapsed of its own decadence, something inevitably better will have risen out of its ashes, which I think is an unlikely pathway to social improvement, given that, in fact, there are much worse situations that we don't even have to imagine them. They take place in many parts of the world, and they certainly were the norm in the past.
Do you have the sense that many Americans have given up on reason and sympathy as you talk about them in your book?
Well, certainly, reason isn't as prominent as it ought to be. There are on both sides of the political spectrum, a habit of endorsing whatever policies are part of the brand of the political tribe that one is affiliated with, whether it be on the left or on the right. There's a suspicion of science from both the political right and the academic left. Just the notion that we should be open-minded about which policies make people better off, look at the evidence as open-mindedly as we can, and adopt the policies that have the best track record of making people better off. It's not a major part of our political discourse. People's minds are made up. They just know that this policy leads to that outcome without really welcoming studies that would establish the truth one way or another.
To what extent do you believe Americans still hold, in general, Enlightenment values?
It depends on which Americans, but there are large parts of the religious right, including the intellectual religious right, who believe that the Enlightenment origin of the American order was a big mistake, that it just led to licentiousness, to homosexuality, to pornography, to abortion, to general dissoluteness, and that we would have been better off if America had been founded on explicitly Christian principles, for example. And then, as I mentioned, there's the academic left that rejects the tenets of liberal democracy, of markets, of the institutions that have come down to us since the founding of the American Republic, that hopes for some vague, more socialistic alternative, and that explicitly rejects reason as a tool of oppression, that rejects science as a pathway to better understanding of reality and just considers science to be yet another system of mythology. So yeah, the Enlightenment is very far from being a crowd pleaser.
So how did we get to this point where there are people who openly reject the idea that reason is, if not a great tool, the best tool that we have for promoting our own flourishing and that of our fellows?
Well, it's ultimately the only tool, because even if you're discussing whether reason's a good tool or not, you're using reason. There's just no getting around reason. It's how do we get to that point? There are different strands that have pushed people into like-minded ideological tribes. Possibly the segregation of the country into by education, by profession, has led to enclaves in which our common understanding has been dissipated. Also, I think because of the critique of American institutions that accelerated in the 1960s, the recognition that despite the lofty ideals of the American project, there was poverty, there were blunders and evils in Vietnam, there was corruption in Watergate. It led to a general cynicism about all aspects of American institutions that has begun to infect the right as much as the left, hence the calls to drain the swamp in Washington. The ideals that the institutions of democracy are, with all their flaws, are a better way of running our affairs than alternatives like strongman dictatorship and anarchy. It's hard to find explicit champions for that view anymore. I mean, I shouldn't say it's hard to find, but they're not influential enough.
And that's true in the United States. That's true increasingly true in Europe as well.
That's right. Although it must be said that there are leaders who've actually used the word enlightenment, such as Barack Obama in his farewell speech. And he left office with one of the highest approval ratings of any American president in recent decades. Likewise, Emmanuel Macron in his victory speech endorsed the ideals of the Enlightenment. So it's not necessarily a losing proposition in the words of politicians who know how to craft a positive message.
All right. So what do you tell people would happen in their alternate reality of a country that is rooted not in Enlightenment values, but in Christian principles, or for people who ultimately reject markets and liberal democracy?
Well, we have a number of alternatives in history. But in the pre-modern era, there were the wars of religion between Protestants and Catholics that had a death toll comparable in as a proportion of the population to World War I. We see today that societies that precipitously abandon markets like Venezuela in favor of intrusive government control become both more dictatorial and more impoverished. We know that societies based on nationalism and an ethos of blood and soil, as opposed to a social contract, can turn into fascist dictatorships like in Italy, Spain, Portugal, and of course Nazi Germany. We can compare societies like South Korea and North Korea that are similar in geography and culture but vastly different in quality of life because of the different political systems they embraced. So there's no shortage of examples to show why liberal democracy is a really nice invention.
So has liberal democracy and enlightenment values, have they made Americans or people around the world, to the extent that countries celebrate those values and have adopted them, are we happier because of it?
We are. That societies that are liberal democracies with an extensive social safety net are the happiest countries on Earth and probably in the history of our species. So the happiest countries include Denmark, Norway, New Zealand, Canada, Netherlands, all of them democratic, all of them affluent, must be added, and all of them with a pretty substantial social safety net.
I believe it was Joseph Schumpeter who said, capitalism makes us flabby, and then we have to deal with being flabby. Has the Enlightenment produced a society in which that has set the stage for its own destruction? That is to say, it's easy to disconnect from those values as you pursue your own happiness?
I don't think so. Certainly, despite some backsliding in the last 5 years or so, the number of democracies has increased, and I don't think they're on the verge of collapse. Though they are facing pushback from authoritarian populist movements, but it's not as if they're getting so decadent that people are no longer showing up for work, creating art, coming up with scientific and technological innovations. So I don't see societies liberal democracies on the verge of a collapse from anomie and boredom and a sense of meaninglessness. Also, they are the top destinations of people who vote with their feet. So people who aren't in them think they're a pretty good idea.
One thing that I found absolutely shocking, even for somebody who works at the Cato Institute day in and day out, which was the just a chart that you have in there featuring the number of nuclear weapons mostly between the United States and the Soviet Union, but in dramatic decline.
Yes, 85% decline since the height during the Cold War, with more reductions to come. Although it must be said that in exchange for getting Congress to approve the New START Treaty that set the stage for the latest round of reductions, former President Obama agreed to a so-called modernization of the nuclear force. So there will be a pretty big expenditure on replacing the weapons that we have at a time in which we'd probably be better off reducing it. Well, in fact, heading towards zero. But there will be reductions in sheer numbers.
Yeah, but it seems like in some ways that's great. And in other ways, it seems irrelevant because our ability to blow everybody up is still there.
It is still there, although every armed weapon presents an opportunity for an accident or miscommunication.
That's true.
If there are a sufficient number of weapons, then we're starting to flirt with the possibility of nuclear winter or at least nuclear autumn, whereas a smaller arsenal takes that off the table.
How much of this is programming? I know people who are congenital pessimists. I know people who are congenital optimists, and it seems to me that to a certain extent, the pitch that you're making is just not going to get some people, is just not going to reach some people.
And it would be grandiose to think it would reach everyone. So yeah, there are people it won't reach. I can just say in my own autobiography that I haven't consistently put forward an optimistic vision of everything. When I wrote The Blank Slate, about the modern denial of human nature, and I argued against The Blank Slate, I argued that there is such a thing as human nature, and it has a number of dark impulses. It was something of a tragic view of the human condition. And for me, it was actually seeing graphs that plotted improvements in human well-being, declines in crime and slavery and war deaths and child abuse and domestic abuse that prompted me to write the book. It really was data-driven rather than temperament-driven.
I think a lot of people have that sort of temperament as well, which is whatever they see around them is presumed to be if you extrapolate it out to the broader world, the world must be going to hell if what I see around me is bad.
You know, it's not so much what people see around them, but it really is what people consume from the media. Because there, people tend to be far more optimistic in describing their own lives, their own schools, their own neighborhoods, than in opining about the country as a whole or the world as a whole.
Sometimes it's like I love my congressman, but Congress as a whole is terrible.
Exactly, and my kid's school is pretty good, but the nation's schools are going downhill, and my neighborhood feels pretty safe, but crime is increasing in the rest of the city. So there is that misperception, often driven by a view of the world that's fed by news stories, simply because news consists of events rather than trends. And as long as misfortunes and violence and suffering haven't vanished from the face of the earth, which they never will, there'll always be enough horrible incidents to fill the news. And so our perception can get out of whack with reality if it's driven by the images and narratives and anecdotes, and we aren't mindful of the trends and the recent history.
I feel like we discussed this before, but the last time you were here, but are humans... I mean, my sense is that humans are programmed to have a certain amount of anxiety and worry about the world. And if it's not a big thing, it's a small thing. And by virtue of our capacity to worry about it, it becomes a big thing.
There is truth in that. It's sometimes called the negativity bias, that bad is stronger than good, that negative events are way more on us than positive events. We dread losses more than we anticipate gains. And which probably served a function in making us vigilant for the huge number of threats that could do us in. There aren't that many things that could make us a leap better off, but there are a lot of things that could make us much worse off. And so we do tend to pay undue attention to them, and to, for that matter, to listen to people who might point out risks that we may have overlooked. So we venerate prophets who warn us of impending disaster.
Steven Pinker is author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.